The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
Who was Tummuth?
Tummuth was my great-great-great-great-grandfather. He was the headman of the Wotlala people. The anglicized version of that is the Cascade people. They were a community of indigenous people who have lived along the Columbia River for about the past 10,000 years. They were broken up, dispersed in the mid-1800s by Philip Sheridan and the U.S. military. And Tummuth was a very young chief at the time. He was in his mid-20s when he was the headman of the Wotlala people. And he was hanged by Philip Sheridan in 1856. Sheridan is really well known as the person who first said, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian." And so he was the one responsible for hanging Tummuth and a group of other Wotlala headmen.
Hello, and welcome to The Right to Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. Alyssa Washuta is here, and we're talking about her memoir, My Body is a Book of Rules. Please note that some of the topics we'll discuss are not appropriate for young listeners. You grew up in New Jersey, and as a child, what were you told about your Native American ancestry? Did you visit Washington a lot?
I did. I visited Washington a lot, and I heard stories. I was born in New Jersey, and I always knew that I was Cowlitz, and I remember being really young and trying to spell the word Cowlitz, C-O-W-L-I-T-Z. That was a tough one for me, learning to spell. And, you know, I always knew that I was Indian. I always knew that I was Cowlitz. And, of course, growing up far away from my tribe, you know, that became difficult for me in a land that has a very different history of colonization than the history of colonization, you know, from where my mother's family is from. So I did go back to visit, and I did learn from, you know, my grandma and from my aunts about, you know, about what it meant to be Indian. But it also became very complicated for me to grow up in New Jersey, where a lot of people's understanding of Native identity is based on stereotypes.
The movies, books, yeah.
Absolutely. Movies, books, mascots. And then also in New Jersey, there's a lot of ghost stories and lore about Indian hauntings and ghosts of Indians roaming the land. And I think a lot of that influences the way that people in the place where I grew up kind of had an understanding of what Indian identity was. Indians were people who had vanished.
And the fact that you aren't very brown, mm-hmm. then you could either function in society or in school as a young child as just a plain white person, or how did that work for you?
Right. Yeah. I had the privilege of passing as a white person growing up. And that also created a lot of ethnic identity confusion for me, because I knew myself to be Cowlitz and Wotlala. That's what I knew about myself. But other people didn't necessarily know all of that about my family and about my ancestry and about my beliefs about the world. And so it created a lot of friction and tension when it came time for me to go to college. And that was a time when people really were very concerned about affirmative action, and especially when it came to funding for school. I received a very, very nice scholarship from the University of Maryland. They gave me a lot of money to go to school. And It was a merit scholarship. It didn't have anything to do with minority funding, didn't have anything attached to it in that way. But people in my high school and then later in my university gave me a really, really hard time about it. They said some, you know, really repulsive things to me. And then, you know, kind of some more passive aggressive things to me. And I wondered for a long time whether I deserved that money. And it took me a long time to work out if I was given money for being Native American, did I deserve it? Was it important to fund me just because I was Native?
I know from reading this memoir that you are a smart person who probably more than deserved the scholarship, but people probably thought you were taking money away from a white person who didn't get it.
Right.
Yeah.
That was what I got a lot of the time.
Maybe that you were being an Indian when it was convenient.
Exactly.
As part of your childhood, you went to Catholic school for many years, and there are a couple of passages that I'd like you to read that I think are maybe funny now that you look back at it and you've done a good job of putting humor in it, but it must have been really traumatic when you were in school.
It was, and I think there were times when I knew how traumatic it was and times when I just knew that this was school. This was all I knew. I went to a Catholic school from kindergarten through seventh grade, and we learned, you know, as any Catholic school, really, the normal subjects, and I got a good education in, you know, I learned how to diagram sentences, which was super helpful for me, and I got a really good education in the normal subject areas, but I also got a really problematic education in the catechism that has stayed with me for a long time.
Especially as it relates to your body, as the name of your memoir suggests. So why don't you go ahead and read a couple passages from that chapter?
While I learned so much about girls who died with their virginity intact, I never heard a word about male saints' virginity. In the catechism, nuns' virginity is called for, while priests are asked only to be celibate. Virginity isn't mentioned. Christian history is peppered with virgin martyrs who appeared after the Roman period, such as Joan of Arc and Maria Goretti, known for their unique stories. Sister Agnes was obsessed with Maria Goretti, the little saint who was murdered at the age of 12 by a young man whose advances she had spurned. Maria Goretti was to be a model for us girls. Die before you open your legs and disappoint the Lord. When the nuns found out I was Cowlitz Indian, they offered me Blessed Kateri Tekawitha, the Lily of the Mohawks, as a spiritual guide. I knew nothing more than that she was holy and that I was to ask her to speak to the Lord on my behalf. On prayer cards, she was rendered with deep honey skin and delicate anglicized features. Behind her twin braids shone the circular halo that adorned the heads of all saints. She was Indian, and I was Indian, so the nuns thought I would respond to her. They never told me about the smallpox scars that disfigured and half-blinded her. Mohawk accusations of sorcery and promiscuity in response to her conversion, or her self-mortification practices that included whips, hair shirts, iron girdles, and beds of thorns. Catherine, post-conversion, could withstand up to 1,200 self-induced lashes at a time. Prolonged fasting brought clarity. Hot coals brought her closer to God. While Kateri's bloodletting had once taken traditional Mohawk forms, Jesuit priests supplied all the instruments of self-ravage that a good Catholic girl might need to purify her dark native heart. In 1680, at the age of 24, Catherine died a virgin. The old Kateri was long gone, and miraculously, so were the scars that had once marked her face, now perfectly pale. I could not pray to Kateri Tekawitha. She seemed more like one of my Native American Barbies than a saint. With her braids and ethnically confused features, her prayer card image reminded me enough of myself that I found it impossible to venerate her. Kateri could not be trusted to do any better than I could with my desperate implorations to the Lord.
Well, you eventually gave up Catholicism, but you were a virgin until age 20.
Mm-hmm. I didn't stay a virgin so long for religious reasons because I stopped believing long before the age of 20, but I had a lot of fear surrounding loss of virginity, and I knew it was going to hurt, and I wanted it to be with someone I trusted, and I wanted it to be at the right moment, you know, as so many girls do. And at the same time, there was also not this fear that was just kind of surrounding my own self-preservation and my own self-care. There was some of that, but there was also this fear, this burden that I think really stemmed from this whole notion of pleasing God, pleasing men, pleasing everything that came out of this Catholic education. And so there was this fear that I wasn't going to be able to do it right. And so I was putting it off and I was waiting until some day when I was going to be ready. And so at age 20, I was raped by someone who I was seeing, so someone who I was, you know, messing around with, and I wasn't ready, and I had told him I wasn't ready, and it was a very scary thing to have that wall that I put up punctured, and that barrier between my unreadiness and the readiness that I projected out into the future, that barrier I put up was just torn down by someone else.
And you wrote that to him it was just a difference of opinion. You said no, he said yes. Do you think that your confusion about whether or not to report this as a rape came from what you had learned in school?
I think more than in school, it had to do with what I was learning from what's out there in the world in general, in pop culture. I mean, in that chapter about Law and Order, I talk about how over and over in that show, they talk about evidence and what can be brought to the police. And I just believed that what had happened to me was absolutely too complicated. And that since I thought that I had said no and then had just given up and allowed it to happen, there was just no way that I could ever bring it to the police. That if I had cracked and allowed it to happen, that's how I felt, that I had cracked and allowed it to happen, that if I brought it to the police, I would crack under whatever line of questioning would come up, that I just didn't have the strength to bring any kind of justice or closure or any kind of goodness to the situation.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Alyssa Washuta about her memoir titled My Body is a Book of Rules. If you just tuned in, you can hear what you missed at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link on our Facebook page. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about bipolar disorder, medication, Britney Spears, and Kurt Cobain. Don't go away. there were ways in which at this point of your life you were really trying to hold yourself together. You write about knowing that there was something wrong with your mind for many years before you went to seek treatment. And the reasons had to do with what you observed happened to other people, other students in college.
At the same time that I was suffering from manic episodes and depressive episodes of bipolar disorder, I knew someone who was similarly suffering at the same time. And then after I left college, he killed himself. And I knew other people who were also suffering in different ways. And a lot of us did the thing that's kind of typical of a lot of college students and a lot of people in general, I think, which is to try to treat these episodes of mental anguish with the thing that sort of seems to assuage that pain and make it feel better, but is actually the most harmful thing for treating that pain long term, which is, you know, stuff like alcohol or overuse of prescription drugs like Ativan and, you know, other benzodiazepines. Going down those rabbit holes just really made things a lot worse for me. When I was drinking too much, that really worsened the depression. And I saw that with so many other people in college as well.
And you also noticed people who did try to get help and they were asked to leave.
That's what happened to my friend who killed himself eventually. Freshman year, he had a more publicly noticeable suicide attempt. And when he sought help for what was going on with him, he was asked to leave college for a year. And so the second time it happened, he really suffered in private because he wanted to try to finish college, but it just got to be too much for him.
But you did eventually seek help.
I did. When I noticed that my episodes were not just the things that I was blaming it on, I thought, you know, that I was experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder because of the rape. I thought maybe I was at one time just experiencing really intense crushes, and I at other times thought maybe I had a spending problem, but then eventually I realized that no, this is something that is more resembling a mental illness. I need to go talk to somebody. And at first, the people I talked to were not helpful. I first saw somebody who told me, well, what you need to do is you need to make a schedule for yourself. And you need to make a schedule for when you're going to cook your meals. And you need to make a schedule for when you're going to do your homework. And a schedule for when you're going to have your free time and what you're going to do in your free time. And that didn't work for me. So I just kept pushing and kept seeking help until I found a psychiatrist on campus who would see me and take me seriously and medicate me. And that is what I found I absolutely needed.
And then you had to go through the trauma of trying all the different medications and the side effects and all of that. You write about the kindling effect. Can you explain what that is?
The kindling effect is a notion applied to bipolar disorder and some other disorders and conditions. The idea is that if an episode of bipolar disorder goes untreated, it can contribute to future episodes becoming worse. So it's kind of a snowball effect. So the idea is that it's a good idea to kind of nip episodes in the bud and treat early, because the longer bipolar disorder goes untreated, the worse future episodes might be.
And is that something that's scientifically proven?
I'm actually not sure how widely accepted it is, but it's certainly something that my psychiatrist during college believed, as far as I know.
You also write about Britney Spears.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you are not pals with Brittany, so you don't know what's going on with her, but yeah, you made some comparisons.
Yeah, I really started to identify with her once I was in graduate school, and her meltdowns became very visible and very public. I became absolutely fascinated with Britney Spears. There were some rumors that she may be bipolar and that she may be on drug treatment, and I really felt a lot of empathy for her and for the difficulty of getting your brain right when you feel that you are under tremendous pressure. I wasn't under the same pressure that she was under, but I had moved across the country to go to graduate school and to try this new thing as a very young person. And I felt that the stakes were pretty high for me, not as high as having a huge tour for the Circus album, but they were high in my own way.
And being photographed every time you get out of your car.
Exactly. That hasn't ever happened to me.
You also mentioned Kurt Cobain.
Yes.
And his suicide in connection with your own bipolar.
I found a lot of parallels between myself and Kurt Cobain, not because I was ever suicidal, because I wasn't, but just that idea of the brooding part of myself. I started to feel that because of bipolarity, I did have different parts of my mood, the manic part that I recognized in Britney Spears and the brooding part that I recognized in Kurt Cobain.
And you also talked about mixed moods.
Mm-hmm. So the form of bipolar disorder that I have is mixed bipolar disorder. So I don't have pure mania very often at all. And I don't have pure depression that often either. More often, I have mixed episodes, which are kind of defined as having mania and depression at the same time. It's a really, really difficult mood episode to have. It's defined as one of the more dangerous mood episodes because it's a really low mood point, but also an active mood point.
I can see that it would be easy to question yourself. You know, am I really having a manic episode? Although once you went on medication, there was no doubt.
Right. The definitions of bipolar disorder usually point to signs of mania, the crazy spending sprees, the acting out with hard drugs or other things that are extremely recognizable. And I really didn't have those things. Mixed mania, I think, is a lot more difficult to discern. And so I did question myself a lot trying to figure out, do I have bipolar disorder? And I sort of recognized it before my doctor did. And so at first my diagnosis was depression and I was incorrectly medicated because of that. And because I was incorrectly medicated, I did tip into mania. And I was given antidepressants that caused ultradian cycling, which is cycles of mania and depression that happen maybe a few times a day, which is a really difficult thing during your senior year of college.
I imagine it would be. Well, you've written an extremely smart and very intense memoir. What did your parents think of this book?
It was difficult for them to read, but they told me they loved me.
They're supporting your writing.
Oh, gosh. Yes. They're so supportive. They've been to a couple of my readings on the book tour, and they're just tremendously supportive, always.
That's good.
Unconditionally.
Well, let's finish with one more reading from the book.
In school, when the white kids would get mad at me for being Native and not looking it, which seemed to mean misusing it to get an advantage I didn't need, I wanted to ask them what to do. I think they wanted me to forget I was Indian. Would that entail getting to pick another way to allocate the 3/32 of my blood that will be freed up when I'm not Indian anymore? Am I supposed to stop calling my mom? Or should I issue a poll? How can I be white enough for you? And what do I do now with all the self-tanning foam that never gets me brown enough? Washuta is one vowel away from Washita. Google that. It's a river in Oklahoma. You'll also find that it was the location of an 1868 battle in which Colonel George Armstrong Custer attacked a Cheyenne village. Even though Chief Black Kettle raised the white flag, he and his wife and 100 other Indians were shot dead. Every summer, Chief Tummuth's descendants get together at Beacon Rock in southern Washington's Columbia Gorge. Beacon Rock remains where the Columbia River stripped away the fat from an ancient volcano, leaving the world's second-largest freestanding rock behind. Lewis and Clark reached it and named it in 1805. Everything in Washington is volcanic, and everything is renamed and re-owned. I don't know what Beacon Rock was called, but Wyeast became Mount Hood, Pateau is now Mount Adams, La Walla Clau is Mount St. Helens. We gather in an outdoor pavilion and eat all different kinds of potato salad. Still, years after moving to Washington, I meet unfamiliar relatives there. At first, few truly felt like family. I would wander among people I felt I was supposed to know, but couldn't because they lived on the opposite coast. I understood that they didn't have to love me, which is hard on a girl from New Jersey. But after attending every year, I learned names and relations, and a family feeling began to percolate. I got the hang of it and started to see that there's something special about being invited to belong. We cluster under Tummuth's name and stare at the family tree posted on the side of the pavilion, but everything I've learned about him came from books. I only heard from my mother's mouth that he was a chief, a term nearly as blurry as Indian princess. I grew up thinking that chiefs should have their faces on textbook pages and t-shirts, like Sitting Bull. I couldn't find Tummuth in my book of great speeches by Native Americans, or in any of the books at the county library. I began to worry that my family had made up the whole thing.
Melissa Washuta lives in Seattle, Washington. You can listen to this program again and find more information about her and her book at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Links to that information are also on our Facebook page. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.